Hello, hello. I hope you are all well, and thank you for tuning in to Beats Research Radio, a podcast and YouTube channel dedicated to bringing our community closer to research in the science and engineering fields. My name is Patrick, and I'm joined behind the scenes by my colleagues Nicholas, Kareem, and Eli. We are students from the Translational and Molecular Medicine program at the University of Ottawa, and I'll be your host on today's special podcast episode for the Science Communication course, TMM 4950. I'd like to begin with neurodegenerative disease. ALS, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, Huntington's. I'm sure everyone listening has met or has known at some point in their life someone who has suffered from one of these diseases. They can be cruel and painful things that tend to rob us of our autonomy or our memories or our ability to move and leave us in need of constant care. The burden of such a disease is felt not only by the sufferer, but by their loved ones who also lose so much. In the end, there are no good treatments and life is too often cut short. The need to better these people's lives is great and a noble cause at that. Today, we're going to talk a little bit about imaging the living human brain. Where doing so non-invasively has emerged as one of the most powerful diagnostic tools when it comes to certain brain diseases, such as cancer, stroke, or traumatic brain injury. However, such techniques have historically been less effective when trying to diagnose neurodegenerative diseases such as Parkinson's or Alzheimer's. This is largely because it is hard to know what to look for, unlike in, say, stroke, where large sections of brain matter die off and as such stand out very easily. In neurodegenerative diseases, the physical brain is altered, sure, but in a much more subtle way, usually relating to the death of very specific neurons or the buildup of certain toxic proteins. When it comes to diagnosis of neurodegeneration, it is the presence of symptoms that generally indicates disease, which of course is problematic because such diseases are the result of underlying cellular and molecular pathways that can precede the symptoms by decades. This is all to say that by the time one knows they have a neurodegenerative disease, not much can generally be done about it. As such, there's enormous interest in trying to use biomarkers, correlates of these substances that build up or that appear early in the disease course, try and spot the neurodegeneration early and help predict how the disease will progress. Now, our guest today is Clifford Cassidy, a professor and scientist affiliated with the University of Ottawa and the Royal Institute of Mental Health Research, and an expert in neuroimaging, where he is pioneering the use of magnetic resonance imaging to investigate the neurotransmitter systems of dopamine and noradrenaline, also known as norepinephrine. These systems are heavily implicated in the neurodegenerative diseases, Parkinson's and Alzheimer's, but also in other diseases such as schizophrenia and addiction. Welcome, and thank you for joining us today, Professor Cassidy.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So I've spoken a bit, but what would you say is the focus of your research group?
Yeah, I think you did a good introduction there. A lot of the work we've done is focused on trying to study those two brain systems, dopamine and norepinephrine, which are called the catecholamines. So those are neuromodulatory brain systems that, you know, we've done a lot with animal studies to understand the neuroscience of how those work and applying it translationally to understand human disorders in animals. But I was excited to develop this more novel imaging method to study these systems in humans. So over the years with brain imaging, we've made great progress using different tools like structural imaging. You can measure the size of different parts of the brain, and functional imaging, you have a proxy of brain activity, you know, and then there's PET imaging where you can probe, you know, different molecules in the brain, including neurotransmitter systems. So PET has been the main tool we had access to understand neurotransmitter systems directly in the brain. But, you know, PET has some limitations, despite all its strengths in terms of accessibility, invasiveness with exposure to radioactivity and other types of challenges, and cost. So anyway, it was exciting to help to develop this other method, which is non-invasive, very practical. You can collect using MRI, any scanner, it's quick scan. So this method called neuromelanin MRI to study dopamine and norepinephrine systems and applying it in different disorders. So that's not all of what I do, but a lot of my work in recent years has been focused on developing the methodology and trying to apply it to where it may be most useful.
Yeah, so I'm definitely quite interested in the special type of MRI that your lab has been working with, termed neuromelanin MRI. I think the basic premise is that this neuromelanin, this MRI-sensitive pigment, is found in certain dopamine and noradrenaline-rich brain regions. And as such, it can be studied in humans via MRI. But just kind of breaking it down further, what is neuromelanin, right? How is it related to MRI? And why would this be relevant for like Parkinson's or Alzheimer's? What are some of the fundamentals that people should understand about this this imaging approach?
Yeah, well, as a new approach, there's still some open questions and some debate about how to interpret the signal and how to use it. But there is, you know, I think enough evidence to say that at least a part of the signal is driven by neuromelanin. Neuromelanin is to some degree at low level everywhere in your brain, but it is much, much more concentrated in two brain areas, the substantia nigra and the locus coeruleus. Since neuromelanin is a pigment, those particular brain regions are pigmented. So they're black like the nigras and blue like the coeruleus, like their names. Because we can examine those structures, we can have a window into conditions where those structures are affected. So how does it work? Well, the physics of it, there's different layers of how the signal is affected. But in terms of neuromelanin, it should affect the relaxation times and basically make a bright spot on an image where the locus coeruleus is or the substantia nigra. You can think of it in the context of neurodegeneration just as a marker of the presence of the cells. So if cells are dying off, then there's less neuromelanin because when the cells die, the neuromelanin is cleared. So it's a marker of degeneration of these structures that we can see directly just as the intensity of the image, just basically how bright they are, how much they pop out. So if you look at an image from a healthy person, you should see the substantia nigra really bright relative to the background and the locus coeruleus as well. Whereas some people with advanced neurodegeneration, there'll be a lot less contrast. It won't stick out as well.
Right. So relatively recently then, your research, I think the last couple of years, your research group, along with some collaborators, published a pretty exciting paper called Association of Locus Coeruleus Integrity with Brock Stage and Neuropsychiatric Symptom Severity in Alzheimer's Disease. And in this paper, you're using this neuromelanin MRI to investigate Alzheimer's disease. Could you tell me a little bit about what inspired this work and then what you found?
Yeah, well, for me personally, I think there was two objectives for this paper. One is pretty straightforward, to develop our tools for the locus coeruleus, to make sure we could measure that structure in a condition where it's very clearly implicated. Like it's very well established that the locus coeruleus degenerates in Alzheimer's disease. So if we have a good tool, we should be able to detect that degeneration pretty effectively. So I felt like that would be a good starting point to study the locus coeruleus with neuromelanin MRI. And so that was one simple objective. And the other objective is to get more traction in Alzheimer's disease, to, you know, find out, understand the disease process better, and to better exploit, you know, something we can observe in the locus coeruleus to find out so that we can use it to understand the disease better. And the thing about Alzheimer's is that, in contrast to many disorders that we are studying, people are starting to understand what the disease is and what is the pathophysiology that leads to the expression of Alzheimer's symptoms. But what we don't understand as well is why some people get Alzheimer's and why some don't, and what is the initial cascade that leads to the expression of these markers in the brain that are kind of characteristic of Alzheimer's. So even if we, at this point, you know, have biomarkers of Alzheimer's, like, you know, tau in the brain or even tau in the blood, that's great, but it doesn't tell us how or why it starts. So the exciting thing about the locus coeruleus in the context of Alzheimer's is it seems that that's the place in the brain where tau accumulates first. So even decades before Alzheimer's starts, even in your 30s, you start to accumulate some tau in the locus coeruleus. It's clearly a relevant structure in Alzheimer's. Step one, it accumulates tau first. Step two, it starts degenerating. Step three, it starts having kind of compensatory changes to react to its degeneration. So it's a complicated story, but you know, it's clearly part of the cascade of events. Whether it's really a primary triggering factor or secondary, we don't know. So basically, it's a great opportunity to use this new tool in humans to study the role of the locus coeruleus in the norepinephrine system in Alzheimer's. And at the time that we wrote that paper, there was only a handful of small studies that had used it in Alzheimer's.
Yeah, no, I mean, on the topic of kind of disease course, something I thought was interesting in the paper was this finding that integrity of the noradrenergic system is so strongly associated with perhaps one of the difficult but not often talked about aspects of living with Alzheimer's, which was this aggressive and impulsive behaviors. So I imagine that the ability to predict that the system will or will not develop could be a useful thing for families, right, in terms of how they prepare, and then also for physicians in terms of how they try to treat the symptoms. Would you agree?
Yeah. So I didn't touch on that because it honestly, when you asked about where we started with this, that wasn't in my mind. But, you know, through our collaboration with the McGill Center for Studies in Aging, who collected all the data and who know a lot more about Alzheimer's than me, they said right from the bat, this is something we should look at because that the reason to believe if you want to think about why these neuromodulatory systems would matter in Alzheimer's, it might be for symptoms like that. So, and, you know, as someone who studies more psychiatry than neurodegeneration, it's a good fit for my interest as well. And clearly something that's really relevant and underappreciated in terms of Alzheimer's. Everyone talks about memory impairments, but most of the reason why people end up in a nursing home isn't because they can't remember things. It's because they start to have problematic behaviors and having trouble being independent. So that is indeed what we found, that we saw a strong correlation between the locus coeruleus signal and these types of problematic behaviors in a direction that makes sense. So even if, you know, the norepinephrine system is degenerating, there's been past research that shows that drugs that block the norepinephrine system can help with these problematic behaviors. So what we found was consistent with that in the sense that having preserved LC signal, or, you know, people who had less degeneration were actually having worse neuropsychiatric symptoms. So it could argue for trying to explore this further and seeing whether this could be a marker of who would benefit from those drugs, because they could be a risky type of medicine to use, since, you know, you're targeting a system that's already impaired and you're dampening it down further. In some cases, that might be actually doing more harm than good. Whereas, you know, maybe this could be a marker to show who would actually benefit from such a drug.
Right, yeah. I mean, so it seems to me, but correct me if I'm wrong, that a major long-term goal of using this neuromelanin MRI is in developing ways of predicting, say, in this case, Alzheimer's or Parkinson's. Now, I don't think we're quite there yet, but the research I've seen so far, it seems quite promising. So do you see a path where in like 30 or so years, neuromelanin MRI will be a go-to tool for every neurologist in the diagnosis of, let's say, Alzheimer's or Parkinson's? Or is it more nuanced than that, where probably other biomarkers and diagnostic tools will be required, and neuromelanin MRI is just a piece of the puzzle?
Yeah, I mean, we're going to say that because it's going to help sell us grants. there's certainly challenges. I mean, it's hard to prove that kind of a thing, especially in the early stages of this work with neuromelanin MRI. We were trying to get grants to do that kind of thing, to say, take a group of people at elevated risk of Parkinson's, track them over time, and see if neuromelanin can predict who's going to convert. Or for other disorders as well. The jury would probably be out for a long time on that kind of thing. Like, in a perfect world, people could get MRIs as part of standard, you know, screening procedures, and maybe it could help. It's probably going to be used most effectively in conjunction with other measures, right? Like, if you could take some clinical scores, maybe some genetic markers and a scan and put it all together, that might be a more powerful prediction than one scan on its own ever would be. What we can do in the meantime is just try to make the measure as strong as we can. You know, even I think that neuromelanin is pretty good in terms of its reliability. Like, you know, these kind of dry points people maybe overlook sometimes, think that's not so interesting. But really, if you can measure something with, you know, say a 20% margin of error, it's almost useless. Like, you have to be able to measure it really, really precisely, because at the end of the day, you're going to need a threshold that can say this person has a high risk or they don't. You know, if you find that you do a test retest, you scan the same person on a different day and their results change more than a little bit, it's not going to be very good. So there's really not a lot of room for error in terms of measurement variability. And neuromelanin is pretty good at that, but I think we have to try to make it better still. So there's a lot of practical issues like that to think about.
So there's certainly room to improve then.
Yeah, like, I think it's better than a lot of measures. Like, say, like fMRI, for instance, is famous for being kind of a noisy measure. Neuromelanin's pretty good.
Well, yeah, that's all the questions we have for you today, Professor. But thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us. I think you're doing some exciting and impactful research, and I think many of us have some personal stake in it. On behalf of our director, Emilio Alarcón, and the entire Beats Research Radio team, we would like to thank you for tuning in. Beats Radio is supported by the Ottawa Heart Institute, the Beats Laboratory, and the Department of Biochemistry, Microbiology, and Immunology at the University of Ottawa. Don't forget to follow our Twitter, YouTube, and Instagram platforms to stay in the loop of our latest uploads. I would like to wish you all good health, and we'll see you next time.